Chapter 26. Hesperus turned from the console aboard my shuttle and shook his magnificent golden head. "It isn't good, Purslane. Could the shuttle have been damaged when we tried to escape? I doubt that there is anything at fault with either the sending or receiving apparatus. Most likely, Silverwings is blocking her signals, or obstructing the return signal from Neume, or from the ships that, we may be certain, are following us." "It's just a shuttle," I said, wondering how he could be sure that we were being pursued. "We could not have been underway for more than 3 hours by my reckoning. The line took that long to have breakfast sometimes. Nobody ever imagined it would need to send a signal across more than a few seconds, or through another ship's drive field," I said, gloom rising in me like a black tide. Nothing was going to daunt my companion. "I asked you to give some thought to moving to one of the other craft, if it could serve us better either as a place of sanctuary or a means of escape. Have you made a short list?" Tiredness was beginning to dull my thoughts. It was still only early evening by Neume time, but I felt as if I had lived through several days since the robot's takeover. "There are some possibilities." Hesperus crossed his massive gold arms.
"Good. Tell me about them."
"There's a ship about 2 kilometers up bay, back in the direction we came from."
"So even further from the door?"
"Afraid so. But I've thought about all the ships in the bay, and this is the one I keep coming back to. It's as if it's telling me to take shelter inside."
"Can it keep us alive indefinitely?"
"It's an old ark, built by nascents. Some other civilization found it drifting and refitted it with a star drive and a few other bits and pieces. It should be able to send a signal beyond Silver Wings. It'll have power and functioning makers."
"Abeyance devices?"
"I think so."
"You think so?"
"I'm trying my best, Hesperus. It's been a while since I was last inside, but yes, there should be caskets. Something I can use anyway. I don't know about you."
"I'll manage. We should leave now before Cadence and Cascade turn their minds to us. Is there a maker inside this shuttle?"
"Only a small one. What were you thinking of?"
"I was hoping we might be able to make you a spacesuit, assuming there isn't one already aboard."
"A spacesuit?"
"You may need one. We can't whisk to the other ship, and we can't count on the presence of air in your cargo bay."
I blinked hard. I can't remember the last time I wore a spacesuit. No, wait, I got into one when I visited the Vigilance.
"That was Campion, if I'm not mistaken."
"Memory bleed. No, the Maker won't be able to help us. It would have to assemble the suit in pieces. There might be one tucked away in the back hold, I suppose."
"Do you consider it likely?"
"Not at all. A ship like this, you'd only ever need a spacesuit once in a million years."
"Welcome to that moment. Go and look for a suit, but only spend 2 minutes doing so. If you haven't found one by then, we leave anyway."
I went and looked, but in my heart of hearts, I knew it was hopeless. This ship had logged billions of hours of safe flight without ever putting its passengers in the embarrassing position of needing spacesuits.
"Once we are in the Ark," Hesperus said, "it may be problematic to return here. Let us be certain that we are leaving behind nothing of value, nothing that can't be fabricated by the Ark's makers."
"There isn't anything. We don't even have an energy pistol to our name."
"Then we leave now. Give me explicit directions to the ship in question, describe it well, and describe the boarding procedure."
I did as I was asked. Hesperus nodded slowly.
"Yes, I remember passing that ship as we attempted our escape. There was a door 38 meters from the bow. Are you certain it will permit me to enter?"
"There are no security seals in place. Why should there be? We're on my ship."
"It was necessary to ask."
Hesperus returned his attention to the console.
"Go to the door and wait for me. I will be with you in a moment."
"What are you doing?" I asked, as his hands worked the controls again.
"I am increasing power to the drive."
I felt the shuttle buck in its restraints.
"We tried that. It didn't work." "I'll explain when we're on our way. There isn't time now."
By the time I had lowered the ramp and made my way to the docking catwalk, Hesperus was done. I could hear the warning alarm sounding from the console.
The shuttle was straining, but going nowhere.
What did you just do?
He strode down the ramp and palmed the control to retract it back into the shuttle and seal it from the outside.
Let me carry you. The quicker we reach the Ark, the better. We are almost certainly being observed.
This does nothing for my dignity.
That makes two of us.
Hesperus cradled me and accelerated quickly into his superhuman sprint, heading in the direction of the Ark. His legs became a blur of gold, but the ride was as smooth as if we were levitating.
Hesperus, what did you do to the engine?
As I have already mentioned, we are almost certainly being pursued. The shuttle's motor is now working against Silverwing's parametric engine, causing a tiny decrease in drive efficiency.
You're right. It's tiny. That's like trying to slow down an ocean liner by dipping a twig in the water.
Nonetheless, we have many twigs.
I don't understand.
The bay is full of ships. When we are safely aboard the Ark, I shall endeavour to turn on as many engines as possible. Even if I am only able to activate a few, it may negate Silverwing's drive efficiency by as much as 1 or 2%.
That's not going to make Cadence and Cascade very happy.
And if I could think of something to make them even less happy, I would do it.
Hesperus paused, then said,
Oh dear.
Oh dear what?
I just detected a micro-change in the air pressure.
I looked behind him, back the way we had come. The bay door was beginning to open again, inching upward to reveal a narrow crack of interstellar space.
The pressure curtain, I said. They've deactivated it. Take a series of deep breaths, Purslane. I believe we are about to lose our atmosphere.
The squall hit us a moment later with the force of nearly 50 cubic kilometers of air draining into vacuum. A noise that began quietly and distantly, gradually increased in power until it was the sound of the universe being torn in two. We still had at least a kilometer to go. I tried to speak, but I could not hear my own voice above the howl of the escaping air.
Hesperus cradled me tighter and contracted his upper body around me, his legs seeming to move even faster. The gale became a solid wall of resistance, one that would have swept me into space had I not been anchored to Hesperus. I had no idea how he was keeping himself from being blown away. His feet must have been binding themselves to the catwalk with every tread. From somewhere in the distance I heard a sound that, as impossible as it seemed, was even louder than the wind's roar. Through slitted eyes, I saw one of my ships tumbling towards us, torn loose from its moorings. It was wheeling end over end, smashing into the larger vehicles which were still anchored. It was only a runabout, but it would pulverize us if it came our way. Just as I was thinking that, the loose ship jarred another one, and sent that drifting, picking up speed as the wind tugged at its hull. The runabout dashed itself against the hull of an 11th intercessionary scow, shattering like an old boned carcass. Something came spinning towards us, out of the wreck. I turned my head instinctively, as if that would do the slightest good. Hesperus let go of me with one arm, taking my full weight with the other, and I saw a flash of gold as he batted aside the spinning object. The remains of the runabout tumbled past, followed by the second ship it had knocked loose. I turned back in time to see the wreckage slip through the open door, and then I had to close my eyes against the stinging wind. I took another breath, and the air was thinner and colder than it had been before. The chamber was emptying itself even faster as the door opened to its fullest extent. Then I took another breath and my lungs closed on nothing, like a fist reaching for a handhold that was no longer there. I must have blacked out, although I do not remember the slide into unconsciousness. But when I came around, Hesperus was kneeling over me, and we were somewhere warm and white and silent, somewhere with gravity, and I could breathe. We are in the Ark. You lost consciousness, but I do not think any great damage was done. Do you feel all right?
No.
Perhaps that was not the best way to phrase the question.
I'll mend. How long was I out?
A few minutes. But you were only without air for 90 seconds. I was able to work the door as you instructed.
Hesperus patted the white wall behind him.
You chose well, Purslane. This ship will serve as our sanctuary, for now at least.
He helped me stand, his hands as gentle as a lover's.
Are we all right now? The Ark has brought itself to life, so there is definitely power. All indications suggest that there is now a hard vacuum beyond the door. The rest will be revealed once you have shown me to the control center.
I think the bridge is this way, I said, indicating a passageway.
Then lead on.
We walked through the Ark, taking twisting and turning white corridors, until we reached the dome-shaped bulge above her whale-like bows where the bridge was situated. Along the way, we passed the ancient galleries that would once have held sleepers, ranked row upon row like stone figurines on a cathedral wall. Now all that remained were the coffin-shaped alcoves where the sleeper equipment had once fitted. The civilization that had converted the Ark, nearly as forgotten as the one that had made the ship in the first place, had intended the galleries to be used for freight or recreation, widening the doors accordingly. Other galleries had been filled with the elephantine machinery of the Ark's star drive and associated systems, which filled fully a third of the available volume. I could not remember whether her remaining cargo holds were empty or crammed with more of my junk. The bridge was a circular room with a low dish-shaped ceiling. Padded, lounge-like seats in white leather surrounded a circular command core, with a transparent display sphere poised above it. Branching white control stalks emerged from the core, ending in squeezable bulbs or delicate, trigger-like grips. Illumination was provided by floating baubles. There were no windows. The walls were blank except for patterns stenciled in pale lilac. Almost everything in the room was white, with an almost total absence of shadows or contrast.
"Do you mind?" Hesperus asked, gesturing to one of the waiting seats. "Go ahead. See what you can find out."
I stood behind him as he settled into the seat and took the controls. Almost immediately, portions of the white floor folded upwards to form display panels, bending and tilting to present themselves to Hesperus. Acres of dense red text and diagrams flowed obligingly into place. The language was a fussy series of squared-off pictograms.
"Ring any bells?" I asked warily. "I've seen it before. I'll just take a moment to retrieve the translation filters from deep memory."
"Great. I kept meaning to convert all these ships to line control standards, but I just never got around to it."
"That'll teach you."
"Teach me what?"
"Never put off until the next 1,000,000 years what you can do during this 1,000,000."
After dispensing this advice, Hesperus fell silent, his hands twitching and the text and diagrams slamming past in a pink blur, impossibly fast.
"Give me some good news," I asked, after a while. "Well, there is power, as we have already deduced. The important thing is that there is more than enough for our needs. The star drive reports operational readiness. Life support appears to be functioning normally. We have inertia control and impassors. We have real thrust engines for taxiing to clear space. If there were no obstacles to our egress, we could take this Ark out of the bay immediately."
I scratched my neck. "So why don't we?"
"Cadence and Cascade have complete control, Purslane. They opened the door with the intention of killing you. Now that the air is gone, I have every confidence that they will have restored the curtain and sealed the bay again. We wouldn't get very far, I'm afraid."
"We could try."
"We would die in the process. At least for now we are alive, with options."
"And they would be..."
"We can inconvenience our hosts by slowing down your ship. You will need to furnish me with a list of those vessels that have working parametric engines. There are too many for me to visit the entire contents of the bay."
"I can do that. What other options do we have?"
"We will attempt to contact our pursuers, and thereby determine our position, speed, and approximate heading. Then we may begin to speculate as to the nature of this undertaking."
"We're heading back to machine space."
"Yes," he said distractedly. "You sound as if you're not sure of that."
"I am sure of nothing, Purslane. It has been a long time since I left the Monoceros Ring, but nothing in my experience suggested a widespread appetite for war. Quite the opposite. Most reasoning thinkers wanted nothing but peace and prosperity for both our meta-civilizations. I was sent to investigate anomalous records in the Vigilance Archive, for the sake of completeness and curiosity. I was not sent to make war or enemies."
I realized this was the first time he had spoken with any certainty of his mission.
Then what about Cadence and Cascade?
They may have been sent by another faction within the machine, people. What their agenda is, I cannot yet say.
But you have ideas.
I have pieces, fragments of ideas, and one very large, very disturbing truth, which I will soon be obliged to reveal to you.
Tell me what they sent you for, I said, with a sense that the world was about to spring open a trap door under my feet. Hesperus made a few further adjustments to the controls, but did not answer my question.
I have secured the external doors. Nothing will be able to enter without the use of force.
That's not particularly reassuring under the circumstances.
I will not overstate our chances. If they have access to Silverwing's systems, they will be able to forge weapons and devices of vast penetrating force. But we have makers as well. We can defend ourselves. And ultimately, we have an option they do not.
I heard something ominous in his tone.
Which is? We can destroy this Ark. If the engine were to self-destruct, I doubt that any containment system would be able to stop the detonation before it touched every other ship in this hold, not even if Silverwings tried to place an impassor around her bay.
Then we have a way of hurting them. I did not need to state the dark corollary.
It would be instantaneous, Purslane. If you were afraid, I could complete the operation while you were in abeyance.
Well, let's not jump the gun on that plan just yet.
I just want to make sure we both understand what we are capable of doing.
I get it. Will Cadence and Cascade work it out as well?
They will know we are capable of it. Whether they think we will do it is another question entirely.
Do you think they know we're still alive?
They know that I am still functioning, and that you were alive until you lost consciousness. I do not think they are capable of monitoring our activities inside the Ark.
They'll see you when you leave.
I'll move fast, alter my coloration, and endeavor to use the ships and other obstructions for concealment.
I'll need time to come up with that list, if I had access to my trove.
I have confidence in your abilities.
His tone became brisk, businesslike.
Now, with your permission, I shall bring the Ark's engine to taxiing power. I will not risk a greater application of pseudo-thrust, for fear that the ship would break itself free of its docking cradle.
Do it, I said, standing back while he worked. Hesperus coaxed the slumbering engine into life, warming it for the first time in tens of subjective millennia. Many ships would have balked at such a demand, for the Ark, which had been outfitted for a long and venerable existence in its second life, this was not an unreasonable request. The red writing and symbols flowed onto white panels that had previously been blank. A series of chimes sounded, and there was a momentary surging sensation that had me grabbing for support. Then there was only a distant throbbing, not so much a sound as a subsonic impression. Silverwings was bending space in one direction, surfing the distortion. The Ark was trying to flatten it out again.
Do you think they'll notice? Undoubtedly. They'll notice the effect even more when I've performed the same trick with a few more ships.
I thought of the list he wanted from me. I could name some of the ships already, but I did not want him to leave until I was as sure as I could be that I had remembered them all.
I need something to write down the names and positions. Simply state them aloud. I will remember everything of importance.
He made another delicate adjustment to the console, causing a new series of chimes to sound.
I have activated the Ark's hailing transmitter at full strength. I have put it on a cycling frequency sweep so that it stands the best chance of penetrating the bay walls and the wake distortion behind us. The ship will inform us if it receives a return signal.
There may not be anyone behind us.
Do you think Campion would let you go without an explanation?
He'd need Bettany's permission to come after me.
I rather doubt that would have stopped him.
You're right, it wouldn't. The thought that Campion might be out there cheered me on one level, but chilled me on another. I wanted him safe and sound somewhere, not risking his existence for my sake.
Hesperus, I said hesitantly, what you were saying just now, about a disturbing truth, are you ready to talk about it yet?
He stood from the controls, having done everything necessary for the time being.
It's not as if there will ever be a good time.
So let's make it now. He considered my request for a moment, then gestured towards one of the padded white chairs.
Take a seat, Purslane.
Why?
Because you are in a state of acute mental fragility, and what I am about to reveal to you will in no way bolster your strength of mind.
I'm all right. I'm not going to faint.
Sit.
I sat down. Hesperus stood before me, his arms crossed.
I am not Hesperus, he said.
I let out a small, involuntary laugh.
What do you mean you're not Hesperus? I know you. I took you to the spirit. I brought you back. I chose my words unwisely. I was Hesperus. Now I am something more than Hesperus. Hesperus is a part of what I am, a vital part, a treasured part, but not the sum of me. I am as much the man Abraham Valmik as I am the machine Hesperus.
I felt cold, suddenly uncertain of my safety. Stop talking like this.
I can only express the truth. The spirit no longer exists on Naomi. Everything that it was, everything that it ever knew, everything it ever felt or witnessed, is now part of me.
I shook my head in flat denial. That isn't possible. The spirit was still there when we left.
I left behind an empty shell, without a consciousness. It will continue to drift through the atmosphere, going through the old motions, but it is not me. I am in this golden body now. It was time to move on, to become compact once more. I am Abraham Valmik. I was once a man. Then I became the spirit of the air. Now I am close to being a man again.
I struggled to process what I had just been told. Out of all the millennia, all the centuries, all the long days, why would the spirit choose this one to move on?
Why leave when you were safe? I asked. Nothing could touch you down there. Now you could be killed at any moment if Cadence and Cascade decide to wipe us out. That is a risk. On balance, though, I saw that I had no choice. A time of great stability, lasting millions of years, is coming to an end. There was no guarantee that Naomi would be any safer than here aboard this ship.
What do you know?
Everything. Everything and nothing. I mentioned disturbing news, Purslane. What I have just told you, the information concerning my identity, may seem disturbing to you, but it is not the news to which I was referring.
I sank back into the seat. Whatever it is, I'm ready for it.
When Hesperus was brought to me, a truly conscious being, albeit a broken one, he catalyzed a change. It must have been imminent, poised to happen for quite some time. Perhaps I had begun a slow process of waking, a slow realization that it was time to gather myself and move on. But had I, Hesperus, not been brought to me, Valmik, I would still be in that state of delayed transition, like a sleeper trying to rouse themselves from the coils of a lovely and seductive dream, one where the colors and emotions are brighter and stronger than they ever are in the waking world.
We had to help him.
It was an act of singular kindness. We are both grateful, Purslane, but now you need to know the whole story.
My throat was tight. There was acid in my belly.
Go on. Machine people never came to Naomi. Hesperus was the first, or at least the first to come into my presence. But when he came, when I took his broken body into myself, I remembered something. It was an experience that had happened so long ago that I could not truthfully distinguish it from a figment of my own imagination. But when I picked apart Hesperus's memory, I found the key that unlocked the truthfulness of my recollection.
He paused and regarded me with all the intensity of expression his golden mask was capable of.
He was not the first.
You said no other machine people had come before him.
That is correct. 1,000,000 years after the golden hour, 4,000,000 years before the machine people, there were others.
Other what?
Another machine civilization, another race of intelligent, conscious robots.
No,
I said with a burning conviction. I know my history. Nothing like the machine people ever arose before them.
That is what you believe to be true. But the Vigilance discovered evidence to the contrary. It found the remains of this robot civilization on several worlds, scattered across galactic space. The evidence had been misinterpreted. It was assumed that the Priors had been responsible. The Vigilance detected anomalies in the official explanation. The temporal evidence did not fit the Prior hypothesis, and flagged the matter for further investigation. When news of this puzzle reached machine space, I was dispatched to penetrate the Vigilance and learn the extent of their knowledge.
Your mission.
Around the same time, within a circuit or so, Campion must have entered the Vigilance and compiled his report for Gentian Line. Campion Strand must have mentioned this selfsame anomaly, even if that was simply one bright gem in a treasure chest of intelligence. But that gem is where all this began, Perslane. When Campion delivered this strand, the wheels of a great and terrible process were set in motion. That is why you were ambushed, 200 kilo-years later.
All this because of an anomaly in the Vigilance's data.
Because of the significance of that anomaly, to humanity, to the machine people, and most especially, to Gentian Line.
I reeled, struggling to take all this in. It was not just difficult for me to accept the emergence of another machine civilization, when the history book said otherwise. I had lived through that history, seen it within my own eyes. I remembered all the twists and turns, all the savage bottlenecks. I could reel off the names of 100,000 turnover cultures without stopping for breath. There was no room in that litany of known events for something as momentous as the coming of living machines.
I don't get it, Hesperus. How does this have anything to do with Gentian Line? And if those machines existed, why don't I remember them? How did they manage to come and go without leaving a dent in history?
They didn't.
I don't understand.
They left their mark on history. They left many marks. But one by one, systematically and with great thoroughness, the marks were erased.
By the machines?
They were already extinct.
Then who did it?
Hesperus waited a moment, then said with infinite gentleness, as if he had no wish to cause me pain or anguish.
The House of Suns was the secret line tasked to keep this knowledge buried. You and every shattering of the commonality played a part in bringing it into existence. When you were ambushed, it was your own dark instrument turning against you.
Chapter 27. Nausea washed over me, slow and dreary as the tide on a heavy panthalassic. 4 hours had now passed since our departure from Naomi, and still there was no word from Silver Wings of Morning. Charlock, Orash, and Agrimony's ships were now accelerating harder than ever, their usual safeguards rescinded. After much debate, it had finally been agreed that their owners would remain with the 5 trailing vehicles, Dalliance, Bettany's Adonis Blue, and the ships of Sorrel, Tansy, and Henbane, while the 3 lead craft attempted to catch up with Silver Wings and compel her to slow down. Gallengale was still moving into position. It would be some time before he was able to do anything useful. None of us was confident of success, irrespective of whether we believed Perslane was in charge of her ship or the robots. But it was necessary to take this step so that we might learn how far Silver Wings' controlling agency was willing to go. I was alone on the bridge. Charlock, Orash, and Agrimony were aboard other ships, not mine, but the Imagos and those of Bettany, Sorrel, Tansy, and Henbane were in attendance. Gallengale's Imago appeared when he had something to contribute, but was still rendered smokily to indicate his distance from us. We were all standing, hands resting on fuzzy supports only partly imaged. On the displayer, Naume's system was an orrery of worlds with the trajectories of our ships arrowing away from the planet, in luminous, laser-straight lines, bunched so tightly that they were indistinguishable from each other. Ticking indices next to each ship showed our velocities as a fraction of light. Gallengale's ship was approaching on a gently curved asymptote, still more than half a minute out from our position, but pushing hard on the tail of the 3 unmanned vehicles. I had no doubt that he was going through the same nervous exercises as the rest of us,
constantly rechecking weapons and defensive systems. One check should have sufficed. These were systems that had been honed to effectiveness and reliability over the 6 million year existence of the line. But there were some human habits too deeply ingrained to shake. Soldiers polished their swords before a battle, oiled their guns, kissed their good luck charms. I was resigned to another hour of waiting, as the three ships clawed their way within effective weapons range, when we received the signal. It was frequency cycling, using none of the standard Gentian message protocols, but it was undoubtedly originating from Silver Wings of Morning. "It's just a hail," Bettany said, his imago standing the closest to me. He appeared to be looking at my displayer, at the summary of the signal content scrolling down next to the orrery. No deep content at all, unless we're missing something exceedingly subtle. Charlock's figure swayed as a local acceleration surge hit his ship. Like a man on a leaning deck, he gripped the rail before him, the muscles in his forearm tensing with the effort. "We should still respond. Usual point of a hail is to establish contact." "Could be a trap of some kind," Tansy said. Charlock shook his head. "We've nothing to lose. Whoever's running Silver Wings already knows we're following. We may as well find out what they have to say to us." Bettany bit his lower lip. "Why would they use an unfamiliar protocol, rather than Silverwing's own sender?" "Maybe they haven't got a choice," I said. "Perslane has a lot of ships in her bay. If she managed to make it to one of them, she could send us a signal even if the robots didn't want her to." "Then by replying, we run the risk of letting the robots know she's still alive," Sorrel said. "They already know," I said. "Unless you manage to find a ship with a unidirectional transmitter, they'll have picked up this initial send. Charlock's right. We lose nothing by responding, and if Perslane's the sender, it'll let her know we haven't given up on her." Gallingale interjected his time-lagged thoughts. "I'm against responding to this transmission. If the robots want to talk, they should slow down and await instructions. We negotiate on our terms, not theirs. If Perslane's being held hostage, the information that we're in pursuit won't help her." Privately, I wondered if he was still serious about risking a close approach to Perslane, or whether he had been secretly counting on the crisis being resolved before he was called upon to demonstrate his bravery. "If she's alone on that ship, I want her to know we haven't abandoned her," I said. Gallingale didn't respond. My answer would not reach him for another 35 seconds, and it would be as long again before his reply reached us. "Make the response," Bettany said. "You're sure?" "Say nothing about our explicit intentions, but let them know we're here and that we aren't going home." I nodded and cleared my throat. I ordered Dalliance to create a message in the form we would normally use for signaling a start-up civilization, stripping out the embroidery we habitually wove around our messages to confound eavesdropping and impersonation. Then I started speaking. "This is Campion, aboard Dalliance. We're 3 minutes astern and closing. We got your signal, Perslane. I hope you can make sense of this reply. I know you're listening. Listening and still alive. Right now there's nothing in the universe I'm more certain of." Which was a white lie, but only because I desperately wanted her to believe that I would never give up this chase. I continued. "I also know that it was you who initiated that signal, not Cadence and Cascade. If the robots wanted to talk, they'd already have done so using Gentian protocols. I hope you can reply, but in case you're unable, or we are unable to exchange more than a message or two, I'm going to tell you everything I think you need to know. You left Nayume more than 4 hours ago. Since then you've been maintaining 1,000 G's on a heading that will bring you to the innermost stars of the Monoceros Ring in 130,000 years. At the time of this transmission, you are making 0.48 of light and climbing. There are 9 ships following you. We left Nayume as quickly as we could, and we're running as hard as we can. We're not turning around. We're going to follow you all the way until we get you back. Please reply if you can. I want to hear your voice again." With the words choking in my throat, I added, "I love you. Shatterling." It was an effort to keep standing, I was so drained and fearful. I hardly dared to believe that there would be a response. Even if she was alive, There was no guarantee that she had the means to send a more complex signal than the one we had already received. She was also 3 minutes ahead of us. It would be at least 6 before I could expect an answer. Every second became an anxious eternity. When the time had elapsed, there was only silence. The seconds kept inching past. The seconds became a whole minute, as long again as the 6 that had preceded it. Then, miraculously, she answered. Perslane's voice was very scratchy and indistinct. Even when Dalliance fleshed out the message with its own guess as to what she should have sounded like, there was a remoteness in her voice, as if she was speaking through thick layers of glass.
"I'm all right, Campion. I'm with Hesperus. He's alive and he's on our side. We're in the cargo bay in the White Ark. The other two, they tricked us, Campion. They were never interested in helping Hesperus. They were hoping he was going to die, and if he didn't, they were going to kill him anyway."
She paused to draw breath. "There is so much I need to tell you. I know it's only been half a day since we were last together, but I've learned a world of things since then. Most of it's bad as well. I know what the House of Suns is, but that's all I can say for now. Cadence and Cascade may be listening in, and Hesperus says they may not have all the pieces in place just yet. We still don't know what they want with this ship. If they don't want to help Hesperus, why the hurry to get back to machine space? Anything of value that they've learned, they could just as easily signal home. Yes, I know they gave us reasons why that wasn't a preferred option, but given what we now know of their intentions, we may as well assume they were lying."
Perslane paused.
"There's nothing I'd like better than to keep talking, but Hesperus and I have work to do. I'll be back in touch as soon as we're done. I love you, Shatterling. Thank you for coming after me."
When she was gone, I felt as if something as huge and empty as the Boötes Void had pushed its way into my skull. A little later, our imagos gathered around a holographic representation of Silver Wings of Morning, compiled from data in our mutual troves. It was not guaranteed to be an accurate reflection of the internal layout of Perslane's ship, but it was the best we had. So far, no glaring anomalies had leapt out at me. "If she's in the White Ark," I said, stabbing my finger towards the rear of the ghostly form, "that places her in this part of the ship, aft of the parametric engine. I don't remember exactly where the Ark's located. That's an 8-kilometer-long storage hold, and the Ark could fit almost anywhere inside it. Even if I knew, it would still be nigh on impossible to hit the drive or any other vital system without also hitting the bay. If the ships come alongside, they can direct their weapons laterally," Henbane said. "Then they ought to be able to cripple the engine without inflicting significant damage on any other part of the ship."
"Risky," Charlock said.
"But less risky than a stern shot."
Bettany's face was set in a permanent expression of grim determination, as if it had been cast in metal and left to solidify.
"It's settled. We don't open fire on her from behind, even if that plays into the robot's intentions. It doesn't leave us empty-handed. We'll bring the first 3 ships in on parallel flight paths, until they have a clear line of sight onto Silverwing's flanks. Then they'll attempt to disable her engine.
And we hope and pray that inertia suppression cuts out at the same instant, or Perslane will be exposed to 1,000 G's of unbalanced compensation," I said.
"We're all aware of the dangers, Perslane included." "If she were to enter stasis abeyance," Tanzu put in, "her chances of surviving the attack would be immeasurably improved."
"Send her that warning now, and we'll be giving the robots a clear signal of our intentions," Sorrel said. Charlock smirked. "They've probably worked out that we aren't coming with garlands and bouquets."
"Nonetheless, they won't know our exact intentions until those ships open fire," Bettany said. "They may still think we intend to negotiate, or attempt a boarding operation. I agree with Sorrel. We can't warn Perslane to enter abeyance until the last minute."
"And if she doesn't have time?" I asked him.
"She's in another ship, inside her own. It won't protect her against unbalanced acceleration, but it's still better than being completely exposed. I'm sorry, Campion, but that's the best we can do. It's either attack or let them leave unchallenged. If we do that, I don't think any of us will ever see Perslane again."
Chapter 28
Hesperus paced up and down the white bridge of the Ark as I dredged information from my memory, his restless motion quite uncharacteristic of the robot I thought I knew. All I wanted was to talk about the earlier machine civilization, to find out everything he knew and learn what part we had played in their demise. It had been good to talk to Campion. I felt as if a small warm flame was burning inside me where before there had been only an unlit void. But Hesperus's revelation was still dominating my thoughts, to the exclusion of almost everything else.
How did you, whoever I'm talking to, Hesperus or Valmik, know about the extinction? If the machine people were already aware of it, wouldn't they have told us about it hundreds of thousands of years ago?
The machine people didn't know about the earlier race. When they emerged on the galactic scene, they assumed that the existing historical record, as related to them by human envoys, was largely accurate. That's not to say that they didn't anticipate errors and untruths, but they had no reason to expect that history had been rewritten on such a scale, with such systematic intention. For the entire lifetime of my people, we have believed that we were the first true machine intelligence. Soon it will become a knowledge that this was not the case.
You still haven't told me how you knew.
Because machines came to me when I was young. I was talking to Hesperus. Now it's Valmik, right?
We're both here, two faces behind one mask. I'm sorry if I confuse you, but to me it's perfectly natural to switch from one strand of my existence to the other. I am two rivers that have merged into one being, at the confluence.
Hesperus slowed his pacing. More than 5 million years ago, long after the golden hour, but long before I came to Neume, thinking machines found me. I was a novelty to them, huge and slow and wondrous. They were equally novel to me. I saw immediately what they were, human technology that had become haunted, possessed by quick, gleaming cleverness. I had seen smart machines before then, but nothing with the agility and cunning of true intelligence. I knew instantly that these creatures were on a different order of machine. Some alchemy of chaos and complexity had given their minds powers of consciousness and free will.
What happened to them?
They told me that they wanted to make contact with human meta-civilization. Since I had been human once, they hoped I might act as an intermediary, smoothing the diplomatic waters. I urged caution. I had already seen dozens of empires come and go, blossoming and fading like lilies on a pond, over and over, seasons without end. Many of those empires were benevolent and welcoming, but others were inimical to all outside influences. It made no difference to their longevity. The kind empires withered and waned as quickly as the hostile ones, but there was a kind of stability above and beyond planetary life.
The lines, I said with fascinated dread.
It made perfect sense for the machines to deal with them rather than any of those fractious, ephemeral, turnover civilizations. Once they had established harmonious relations with the commonality, which already existed by then, the lines could broker contact between the robots and those cultures they deemed sufficiently stable and open-minded. Piece by piece, humankind would be introduced to its new robot companions. Both sides would prosper in the new alliance. The robots, with their cool, non-partisan detachment from human politics, might form a moderating influence, calming the endless cycle of turnover, bringing a new era of tranquility to galactic affairs. Likewise, the robots had much to gain from contact with human societies, access to the arts and sciences of a million worlds and a million years of human civilization. Art and science fascinated them above all else. They were curious, ravenously so, but there was something about their minds that kept them from being truly creative. The only genuinely innovative act they had ever achieved was to come into existence. After that, intelligent as they were, they could do nothing but ask questions. Supplying answers required intuitive leaps that they just couldn't make.
Then they weren't like the machine people.
No, the machines that came later, millions of years down the line, had something the first wave lacked, but perhaps that was only because the first civilization was never given enough time to invent creativity for itself. In the end,
with enough shuffling of mental permutations, it might have found the missing ingredient. But they never got that chance. To start with, the robots were made royally welcome. They were an intriguing new development, a kink in history's road that no one had predicted. Humans had resigned themselves to never having to share the galaxy with another species. That was both a blessing and a curse. It meant unlimited room for expansion, unlimited scope for raw materials, but it also meant enduring the deathliest of silences. Yes, humanity fractured into a million daughter species, some of which were scarcely recognizable to each other. But scratch beneath the scales, the fur, the tin armor, they were still humans at the core, and no amount of primate babble could ever drown out that silence completely. But now there was company. Granted, the robots had only arisen as a consequence of human activities, but on every level that mattered, they might as well have been aliens. Their minds ran on radically different algorithms. For all their strangeness, they weren't unwelcome to begin with. The robots were few in number and confined to a compact volume of space, safely distant from any old-growth civilizations. They showed no expansionist ambitions. To humanity, an only child growing up in an ancient demon-haunted house, it was like discovering a new friend to play with. And for a little while, that was what the relationship resembled. But then it turned sour. Ancient memories chimed in my head, struck like dusty bells. I thought of a house with rooms beyond number, and a companion who sometimes came to that house. What happened? What so often does in these situations? What began as a creeping subliminal unease, a sense that there was something not quite right, something not quite to be trusted about these new machines, began to mutate into full-blooded paranoia. Not everyone shared it, of course. There were some who never questioned the robots' intentions, but their voices counted for nothing. Those who spoke for the commonality, the movers and shakers within the most prominent lines, started to think about dealing with the machines. Genocide. What they wanted was not subjugation, not control, but the possibility of control. They wanted the ability to neutralize any threat those machines might pose in the future. With great care, a plan was formulated. A number of the robot envoys were captured and dissected, their deaths explained away as accidents that also cost human lives. It took the commonality centuries to piece through the data they had obtained. They had to understand how those robot minds functioned. They failed, utterly and miserably. But out of that failure came one nugget of understanding. They found a flaw in the robots' minds, a weakness that had been preserved through countless evolutionary changes. It was a weakness that could be exploited given time and ingenuity. The commonality devised a means to implant a data structure, a kind of neural bomb, in the mind of every member of that machine civilization. It would spread from machine to machine without the machines ever realizing they were vectors. Over time, it would infect the entire civilization. But the beautiful thing was that nothing would happen. The robots would continue unimpaired. They could keep on moving in human circles for as long as they were useful. Perhaps it would never be necessary to use the weapon against them. That was certainly what the commonality was hoping, even as it acted with what it saw as immense prudence and foresight. But the day that the machines posed a threat to human expansion or hegemony, the neural bombs could be activated. All it would take would be a single, harmless-looking transmission into the heart of their civilization. As soon as the robots started processing that data, sharing it between them, their bombs would start counting down. It wouldn't be instantaneous, because if the robots started dying as soon as that transmission was received, they'd be able to organize quarantine measures, as well as pinpointing the likely origin of their plague. The built-in delay didn't matter to the commonality. The lines had been taking the long view ever since the shattering. I realized that I had been absorbing all this with a kind of numb fatalism, my capacity for surprise or revulsion already exhausted. So what happened? Did the robots turn against us? Hesperus laughed quietly. No. The robots never had warlike ambitions. In truth, They had much more to fear from the organic than the organic ever had to fear from them. That's not to say it would have been peace and love for the rest of eternity. Sooner or later, tensions would probably have arisen, but the robots never lifted a finger against the human meta-civilization.
So what happened?
The weapon went wrong. Either the robots changed, or the humans had not understood their minds properly, but it activated without any external trigger. The robots started to die in vast numbers. To begin with, they didn't know what was happening. They even appealed to the commonality for assistance. That was when the commonality realized what its cleverness had brought about. They were appalled, of course, genuinely shocked by what they had done, but they still didn't admit to any part in it. They stood back as the robots died out. They'd have known enough to design a countermeasure, something that could be spread from robot to robot to disable the earlier weapon before it had a chance to go off. But doing that would have risked exposing them as the instigators of the neural bomb. Instead, they put about disinformation, suggesting that the robots had been infected with something left behind by priors.
How do you know all this, Hesperus?
Because I remained in contact with the machines, right through to the end. Even when they began to suspect what had been done to them, they maintained communication with me. My ties to humanity had been growing looser by the century. They felt I was someone they could talk to.
I shook my head in wonder and bewilderment. So you knew. Across all this time, you knew.
I experienced these events, Purslane, along with countless others.
You think you've lived through 6 million years, but you haven't the faintest notion what that really means.
The weight of all those memories is like an ocean of liquid hydrogen, compressing itself to metal. Every new experience I choose to remember, every new moment of my existence, only adds to that crush. In the deepest, darkest, densest layer of myself, I remembered what had happened to the first machines. But those memories might as well have been entombed in rock, for all that they were readily accessible to me. Even if I chipped them out, brought them into daylight, which I did once or twice, I couldn't be sure they were an accurate record of real events. It took Hesperus to bring them to the surface and confirm what had really happened. When he came, the first of his kind to visit me, his head stuffed full of second-hand vigilance data garnered from your troves, I remembered that there had once been others like him and what had happened to them.
He offered the palms of his hands.
And now I am here, telling all this to you.
Did they all die?
One by one, across thousands of years, they all succumbed, and for a while the commonality lived with what it had done. The lines sought consolation in the knowledge that they had not intended to hurt the robots, but only to make the hurting of them a possibility. They hadn't intended to bring about their extinction, so they couldn't be said to have committed intentional genocide. That was a fine distinction, but one they clung to assiduously. But in the end it wasn't enough just to have peace of mind. The act itself had to be erased from commonality history. None of you remember it because you elected not to remember it, and adjusted your own memories and records accordingly.
We couldn't have done it. It would have been too big, too difficult. The other civilizations... I was voicing objections, but not because I did not believe him. I just wanted an explanation.
More than one line was implicated in the atrocity. The commonality took the necessary coordinating action. At successive reunions, the Thousand Nights were used to delete and modify critical memories. You were all complicit in this. It was not something done to you by shadowy figures beyond your control. At the same time, the shared historical records of the commonality were tampered with. All the lines were coerced into accepting the new version of history. Lines that refused to comply were summarily excommunicated. Outside the support apparatus and information exchange mechanism of the commonality, they withered away.
It can't just have been the lines. If the machines were present in human space, other civilizations would have noticed them.
They did. But turnover took care of them. That and the occasional helping hand from a line.
I don't follow.
The lines take pride in their good deeds, the kind and noble things they do to protect lesser civilizations, their right to do so. But elements associated with the lines have also murdered and suppressed upstart nascents in 6 million years. Do you seriously imagine this has never happened?
I felt sick to my stomach, empty, as if a part of me had been gored out.
You can't know all this. It's one thing to have met the earlier civilization, to have met Hesperus.
He made to turn his back on me, apparently disgusted with my refusal to take everything he said at face value, but halted before the movement was complete.
Can you doubt that your ambush was connected to the things I have spoken about, Perslane? After more than 5 million years, your involvement in that crime has begun to come to light. It was the vigilance that started it. If they hadn't found those anomalous relics, nothing would have happened. But you, Gentian line, with your magpie craving for novelty and prestige, you had to be the first to bring those anomalies to wider attention. Had your shatterlings returned to another reunion, with clear evidence that there had been an earlier machine civilization, it would only have been a matter of time before the full picture came to light. Do you imagine that the machine people would have been prepared to let bygones be bygones, to smile tolerantly at your earlier error? They would have felt a powerful kinship with that earlier culture, and wondered if you were capable of doing the same thing to them, given half a chance. The commonality would have been discredited, but that would only have been the start of it. A human-machine macro-war would have been all too likely, so the rediscovery had to be suppressed. If that meant the casual annihilation of Gentian line, an ambush wiping out nearly 1,000 immortal souls, then that was deemed a very acceptable price to pay. They'd have felt the same way about killing 1 million, or 1 billion. The custodians of this secret won't blink at murder, Perslane. They won't blink at genocide, or the extinction of another civilization. The vigilance was the source of it all. Why didn't they go after the vigilance before all this got loose? The naivete of my question seemed to amuse him.
You make it sound so simple. The vigilance is indestructible, Perslane. A massively distributed Dyson swarm, virtually invulnerable to outside aggression. It has persisted for more than 5 million years, and in all likelihood it will outlive every other civilization in this galaxy. Fortunately, the Vigilance itself didn't appear to quite realize the significance of their find. They were too self-absorbed, too fixated on Andromeda to pay attention to such a local, parochial matter.
After a silence, I said, "Do you hate us now?" "After the kindnesses you have shown me? Hatred's the furthest thing from my mind. But I pity you for what you did." "I don't feel as if I had any part in that crime."
"You all played a role. Some spoke against the plan, but not loudly enough. Some thought it didn't go far enough, that the weapon should have been activated as soon as it had spread to enough robots. Where you stood, I can't begin to guess. That's between you and your conscience."
"The memories we'd changed. Can they be unlocked again?"
"The human mind is a tricky thing for all its simplicity. It resists being treated like a piece of furniture, like a cabinet with drawers and compartments you can slide in and out and replace without consequence."
"I know," I said quietly. "Hesperus, I'm sorry about what we did back then. Or I would be, if sorry were a big enough word. But we don't punish children for the crimes committed by their parents."
"You were not children."
"But once the memory of that crime was erased from our minds, we might as well have been. We can't be punished for something we barely remember doing."
"Would it surprise you if I told you I agreed?"
"I don't know what to think anymore. I just want to do what's right, to find a way out of this mess. If that means surrendering ourselves to the machine people, letting them decide whether to punish us or not, then maybe that's what we'll have to do."
"Given the present state of affairs, I would count on nothing where the machine people are concerned."
"And Cadence and Cascade?"
Hesperus said, "I still don't know why they were sent."
When we had agreed on the necessary course of action, Hesperus and I followed the white corridors down to the Ark's door. We had already used the Ark's own surveillance devices to verify that no large machine had entered the bay since the loss of its atmosphere.
"Why aren't they here yet? I'm surprised they're not waiting outside to ambush you."
"They'll be here sooner or later. At the moment, they may be preoccupied with escaping the pursuit ships. But from now on, you let no one aboard unless it's me, using the code words we already agreed upon."
"Helleborine and Orash," I said, as if he might have forgotten. Hesperus nodded.
"Remember,
Cadence and Cascade will find it a trivial matter to impersonate my appearance and usual manner of speaking, but they'll be expecting me to act like Hesperus, not Valmik. If, for some reason, you don't trust me, even if I use the code words, your last line of defense will be to listen out for Valmik. If you don't hear him, you may assume I am not Hesperus after all.
And then what should I do? If they're outside, it won't take them long to break in.
I can't tell you what you should do in those circumstances, Hesperus said. That's between you and your maker.
You're saying I should kill myself?
I can think of at least one way in which the robots might have killed you already, if that was their intention.
I wondered what his point was. They gave it a damned good go when they emptied the bay.
You survived, though. Their intention may have been to confine you to one place, one ship, rather than to kill you outright. I think they want something from you, Purslane. Something in your head, I presume. Why else would they not have killed you already?
I shuddered to think what it would mean to be interrogated by those lovely silver and white machines, the things they would do to me to get at what they wanted.
I don't know anything, I said. You may not, but it's what they think that matters.
He opened the door into the airlock, preparing to expose himself to the hard vacuum of the cargo bay.
How will you speak to me? You won't be able to make a sound out there. The lock has a simple radio relay. You will hear my voice when it is necessary for me to speak to you. I'll be silent until then. I don't want to help Cadence and Cascade to track me.
How long will you be gone?
Depending on variables, 1 or 2 hours. I can't be more precise than that.
I should go instead of you, with a suit from the Ark and my knowledge of the bay.
It would still take you longer. I can move like the wind when I must.
I stroked my fingers down the muscular armor of his forearm.
Take care, Hesperus. I shall.
After a moment he added, I am relieved, Purslane. I thought you might hate me for what I had to tell you. I've never been one for shooting the messenger.
You did what you had to do. You took it well. Let us hope the rest of your species follows suit, shall we?
The interior door closed on him. Through the glass partition I watched his gold skin darken to ash as he adjusted his coloration. I had never imagined him capable of such an effortless change, but there was now nothing about Hesperus that would have surprised me. The ash became a dark, hyphenated blur as he left the chamber at the speed of a bullet. Then the outer door closed, and I was alone in the white ark, with only my fears for company. That was when it dawned on me that I was the only living thing on my ship. Part 7. Relictus had been confined to our deepest dungeon for 6 years, but not in the conditions to which most of our prisoners were accustomed. He had been allotted 2 rooms, one to sleep in, another in which to eat and continue his studies. He was given a fire to warm himself, candles, paper, quills and ink, a small library of his own choosing. He was allowed wine and the kind of food normally served to the highest-ranking soldiers. Occasionally, he was even allowed a visit from a courtesan. The only thing not permitted him was the ability to conjure. When he did not need to eat or drink, he wore a heavy mask that muffled his voice beyond the range required for spell casting. When it was necessary to remove the mask so that he could be fed, his hands were bound together. Guards spooned food into his mouth and washed it down with wine, treating him with the servile respect they had been ordered to show. At all times another guard observed him from a few paces away, alert to the slightest trick. That guard carried a knife, ready to slit Relictus's throat. I visited him in the dungeon, for it was considered too hazardous to move him without a good purpose. For my visit he was both masked and bound, facing me in a black chair that was itself bolted to the floor. A guard stood behind him, pressing a knife against his throat. I could see only his eyes, moving behind round holes in the leather and metal covering his face. They were the eyes of a young man, almost a boy. I have a difficulty, Relictus. I believe I have shown you kindness. It is true that you were never exactly a prisoner, but when the nature of your talents became known to us, I was advised that the safest thing would be to cut out your tongue, sever your hands, and burn out your eyes. I did none of these things, because I am a woman of kindness. I had no choice but
to confine you, but I strove to do all that I could to ease the burden of your incarceration. I could not allow you to work magic, but I have allowed you luxuries forbidden to any other prisoner. I do not think you can argue that you have been treated unfairly, given the alternatives." Relictus nodded. I did not know whether that meant yes, he could well argue against my point, or whether he accepted the truth of what I had said. As I mentioned, a difficulty has arisen. It will not have escaped your knowledge that Calidris, your former master, is now a prisoner of Count Mordax. To my regret, but not my surprise, he has turned against us. He has used magic to create an army of ghost soldiers, an army that grows in number by the day, while ours is steadily depleted and weakened. He nodded again, then turned his mask towards the paper and ink on his desk. This was the signal that he wished to write. One hand was unbound. The knife was pressed even tighter against the skin of his throat where it showed under the mask. He wrote, "Tell me of these soldiers. They are suits of armor, but empty. They travel on horses that are either dead or near death, but which move with astonishing speed and stealth. Have you captured one?" "Only the armor, broken and in pieces. It seems that whatever spirit or phantasm is animating these shells escapes when the armor is pierced or pulled apart. Witnesses have spoken of red smoke issuing from the gaps." "Bring me one that is still intact." "I do not know if that is possible." "Divert all resources until it is accomplished. Nothing matters more." "Will you help us, Relictus?" A grating noise came from the mask. I think it was laughter. That night, or perhaps the night after, I was taken from my bed by infiltrators dressed in green. It was a measure of our loosening control that Count Mordax's agents were able to get into the Palace of Clouds unchallenged, and to find their way to my quarters. The infiltrators took me from the palace to a bright white room, where I was molested and questioned. They pushed needles into me and peered into my eyes with shining contraptions. They called me Abigail and kept telling me I had been lost, wandering in a kind of green labyrinth that they called palatial, but that I had been rescued just in time. Fortunately, I escaped from the infiltrators. I wandered bright hallways until, by some artifice of magic or deception, I found myself back in my quarters in the Palace of Clouds. My relief was indescribable. I secured my windows and requested that a double detachment of guards be on duty from that point forward. Yet in the morning, Daubenton was reluctant to speak of the matter, and I began to doubt whether it had actually happened. In any case, I had no shortage of other affairs to occupy my mind. The ghost soldiers were increasing in number, pushing into the kingdom in silent battalions, their swift, pale horses stinking of decay. They had need of a living captain to guide them, but in every other respect they fought like demons. For every man of ours that fell, Calidris made two for Count Mordax. I cursed the day I had touched the blood-bound needle against my finger, thereby bringing this desolation upon us. But I heeded Relictus's request. Against the wishes of Daubenton and Silas, I ordered that men and resources be redirected towards that single goal of capturing a ghost soldier, with its armor intact. It was, I suppose, a kind of necessary madness. We lost villages and towns, as our armies were redeployed from protection duties. Knowing that these orders had originated from me, my name became a curse to those who lost homes, possessions, and loved ones, but I remained resolute. And then came the day when we caught a ghost soldier. It had fallen from its horse into a cushion of hay, the armor remaining intact. My men cornered it. It fought for a while, but with diminishing intent, becoming docile the further away its captain rode, until at last it submitted. My men confined it in a sack, and brought it on a wagon to the Palace of Clouds. Later it was bound to a wooden rack and taken to Relictus. He examined it with great care over many days. Meanwhile the ghost soldiers continued their incursions, steadily eroding the kingdom's frontiers. The green men took me from my bedchamber on another occasion, but again I escaped their wicked enchantments and returned to my rooms. More guards were posted. I mentioned nothing to Daubenton, for, with my strange utterances and flashes of memory, I had already given him reason enough to doubt my faculties. Besides, I had begun to suspect that the green infiltrators were men of my own household, their white room a secret chamber somewhere in the Palace of Clouds. How else to explain the ease with which they took me, and the ease with which I returned to my rooms? It was far from clear that Daubenton was innocent in the matter. 12 days after the ghost soldier was brought to his dungeon, Relictus called for me. With guards at my side, I descended the spiralling stone steps to his rooms. The ghost soldier was still bound to the rack, but its armoured head moved to follow me as I entered. Relictus was still masked, but his hands were unbound. He wore a white smock, dirty with grease. His hair hung in lank coils over the eye-holes of the mask. He muttered something from behind the mask, thrusting his hands forward to one of the guards. "Bind him," I said. "He wishes to speak directly."
"There is a risk, my lady," Searless warned.
"And I have given an order. Bind him and remove the mask." Relictus's face was still that of a young man, but it was wild with ambition and power lust. A guard stood behind him with a knife, the blade pressed against his Adam's apple. "Progress?" I asked.
"I believe so, m'lady."
"Tell me."
"The magic is unquestionably from Calidris's hand. I would know it anywhere. Inside the armor is a being called a false soul. We often spoke of the spells necessary to conjure such entities and set them abroad in the world. It is subtle, treacherous work, beyond the reach of most adepts. Even for Calidris, the conjuring of a false soul was a painful, protracted exercise. He showed me how to do it once, as a demonstration of his own powers. He placed a false soul in an hourglass, and we watched as it moved sand around. Then he vowed that he would never do such a thing again, and made me swear that I would never even attempt it. A false soul is a kind of living magic that, once set in motion, has an existence independent of its creator. As such, it is more dangerous than a spell that is cast to effect a single outcome, and which then ceases to have currency. But now Calidris is making many false souls. Is that possible? If the ghost soldiers are real, then you have your answer. I can only speculate that Calidris has exercised his talents to find a way to make 10 false souls, or 100, as easily as he made one. He sometimes spoke of the methods by which a single spell might be multiplied, by an arrangement of levers and speaking tubes. He looked at the racked figure, which was regarding us both with the pointed metal beak of its visor. The eye slits were glass, I had been told. Examination of the armor of dead ghost soldiers had revealed an uncommon artistry in the fashion in which they were joined and sealed, to keep that red smoke inside. "May I release it from the rack?" Relictus asked. "I believe you will find it very interesting. You will come to no harm. It is quite docile." "Docile?" I repeated, for that was not what I had been expecting, given the ferocity with which the ghost soldiers were decimating our regiments.
"I guarantee it."
I nodded to the guards. Relictus was masked again, still with a knife to his neck. His hands were freed so that he could untie the armored figure. As the guards moved to bind him again, Relictus tapped the mask and mumbled something. "Leave him as he is," I said. "He wishes to use his hands, but not to speak. The ghost soldiers do not respond to spoken orders." Relictus beckoned the figure to step off the rack. Its metal boots clattered on the floor as it took several hesitant paces. Relictus raised his arm. The figure echoed the movement. He gestured a more complicated command, and the figure walked stiffly to the table and picked up his quill. Relictus made it perform a few more simple tasks, then commanded it to return to the rack, whereupon it was re-secured. The guards fastened Relictus's hands and removed the mask.
"Docile," I acknowledged.
"It will do anything you ask of it. Now that it has grown accustomed to me as its master, I could even send it into battle against the other ghost soldiers. It would fight them willingly."
"It would make no difference to us, other than to prove a point. Why is it so easily commanded, Relictus?"
"Such pliability is in the nature of false souls, m'lady. Calidris could do nothing about that. They are essentially innocent creatures who will do as they are told, provided they are told with sufficient authority. Think of them as very obliging children. They may be excellent warriors, but there is no hatred or evil in them. The evil is in those who would create them, or send them to burn villages."
"Then you have learned nothing that is useful to me," I said, preparing to turn away in disgust. Countless lives were lost to bring you this specimen, Relictus. Villages have burned for the sake of your idle curiosity. I expected you to find a flaw, a literal chink in the armor.
I have, he said, almost by way of an afterthought. I can kill thousands of them now, if you command it.
I asked him how such a thing was possible.
They must all be copies of the same soul, or copies of a small number of individual souls. That is the only way Calidris can make them in such numbers. I spoke of the method by which a spell might be multiplied.
Yes.
Think of an apparatus for duplicating his gestures, the precise movements of his arms, the precise movements of his fingers. A mannequin may be conjured to follow his gestures, or it may be done with wire and pulleys, connected to a kind of armor that Calidris fastens around himself. The mannequin may be enchanted to speak as he speaks, or his own voice may be conveyed to another mouth by a series of tubes. Either way, the result is similar. One spell may be said to have the effect of two, or three if the apparatus is more elaborate, or ten. Practically speaking, there is no limit, especially if magic itself is harnessed.
So Calidris gave rise to thousands of false souls with a single spell. I still don't see.
The souls are all the same. They are animated with the same infernal fire. It means that they...
Relictus grimaced, lost for words as he strove to communicate the mysteries of his art to a novice such as me.
Milady, when you summoned Calidris, you did so with the blood-bound needle.
My greatest mistake.
Nonetheless, it serves to illustrate my point. At that moment your pain was his pain, your blood his. A spell had united you. Something analogous applies to the false souls. Each is united with its sibling because they were forged in the same instant, with the same utterance. That is their strength, because it gives Mordax an army of unlimited size. It is also their weakness, because they are all vulnerable to a single counterspell.
A spell known to you?
A spell I am confident I can derive, given a little more time. With every day I learn more of Calidris's work. In a short while I will know enough to formulate the counterspell.
I looked at the armored creature, remembering what Relictus had said about it being as innocent as a child. The empty visor was looking back at me, a glimmer of red smoke showing through the glassy slits of its eyes. I sensed a dim curiosity, much like that of a simple animal or slave, but nothing in the way of malice. I should not have cared to have been alone with the ghost soldier, but I believed Relictus when he said that it was devoid of guile or hatefulness.
And then... what will happen?
It will die, along with every false soul created by the same spell. That might be a regiment of ghost soldiers, or it might be the entire army. Either way, the loss could be decisive.
Then you must do it, I said, and with the utmost urgency. The future security of the human species depends on you.